Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Spring is one of the busiest times of the year for birds. Many of them are doing some serious air travel, and many stop off in Ohio during their travels. This hour, we'll hear some samplings of sound from a handful of bird types that summer in Ohio, and we'll get some expert insight on them from our next two guests. Julie Zickafoos is a widely published natural history writer and artist and author. Her latest book is called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds, and she's also a frequent guest on All Sides and an NPR commentator. Welcome back, Julie.
Thank you.
I ran out of breath.
Yeah.
And also joining us is Bill Thompson III, author, lecturer, and publisher of the Birdwatcher's Digest. His latest book is a reference book for young birders, but I would use it as well. Mm-hmm. It's very nicely done. It's called The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. It's not a baby book. And the illustrations are by Julie Zickafoos. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be back.
And there is some further connection. They are married to each other, by the way. I didn't mention that.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have a question or comment, there they are. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. It's a bird hour. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Stump the experts.
Oh, yeah. Stump the chumps.
Stump the chumps.
Ask about your woodpeckers.
Yeah, well, these?
No, the woodpeckers that peck holes in people's houses.
Oh, yeah, right. We always get a woodpecker story.
We get some woodpecker calls.
Bill, I saw on Facebook that you're leading a bird walk for families and kids this Saturday.
That's right, yeah.
International Migratory Bird Day.
That's right.
It's at the Ottawa National Wildlife Refuge in Northwest Ohio. So what are you going to see there?
Ottawa's great. I mean, the whole north coast of Ohio has a necklace of great green spots that have lots of good migrants this time of year. This is the peak of migration right now, this next week or so. And so we'll see warblers and vireos and tanagers and orioles and shorebirds and, you know, all kinds of stuff. I mean, we're right there on the last bit of woods before Lake Erie. So birds flying all night, if they end up kind of just past the shore at dawn, think, oh, shelter, and they dive back into the trees. So you get really huge concentrations of birds there at places like Ottawa and McGee Marsh and Sheldon's Marsh and just right along the lakeshore there.
You were telling us before you came in that you listened outside, just outside of the Fawcett Center.
Right.
And watched and listened. And tell us what you heard and saw.
I wrote them down because I can't remember them. But I had 35 species, mallard, barn swallow, chimney swift, robin, great crested flycatcher, chipping sparrow. I mean, some of the cool ones, though, warbling vireo, that's a migrant, indigo bunting. And I had broad-winged hawk, red-shouldered hawk, and red-tailed hawk in 25 minutes.
That's a Butio trifecta.
Right. So it's having the river right there and lots of green open space. It was pretty cool.
There are indigo buntings out there, Ann.
Well, let's listen to an indigo bunting. By golly.
I learned that song as a kid as fire, fire, where, there, there, put it out. Kind of stair steps down like that.
Yeah.
And the paired notes are distinctive, the jingling tone in the paired notes.
Da-da-da, da-da-da.
Yeah, I got an email from a woman the other day who said, I need to see an indigo bunting. I've never seen one. And I said, you know, go online, listen to this recording, and listen for it in old fields and pastures and even dumps and roadsides and things like that, because that's the kind of vegetation they like.
Now, are they here all year round or they're coming through? They're just coming through.
I just was walking before we came in listening to birds, and I went around the Alumni Center over here and found a male indigo that had hit the window. And he was stunned, so I picked him up and put him up on the stone wall over by the edge of the woods and waited around to see that he was recovering.
Yeah.
A lot of birds that hit windows like that don't. But, yeah, beautiful male indigo bunting. And
solid
I'll give you the
blue.
I took a picture. I'll give it to you when we go.
They're the blue ones.
Yes.
So a little closer to the mic. My guests are Bill Thompson III, editor of Birdwatcher's Digest and author of a new book. It's called The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. Also, Julie Zickafoos, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator, and author of her latest book is called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Uncommon Birds. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What are you seeing and hearing out there during the Great Migration? Give us a call and tell us. Julie, your blog was entitled Spring All at Once,
yes.
I think, and that pretty much summed up my feelings. It made me sort of miss the drawn-out, solid, cold springs of the past, where you could kind of say, okay, and finally when May gets here, hopefully it won't be too cold or muddy to plant thus and such. And it's been ridiculous.
It has been. It's just that the leaves popped out so early. And so when you're trying to watch the migrating warblers who are headed north this spring, the leaves are far bigger than they are. And, you know, as birders, we get spoiled by these slow late springs where the leaves are still the size of squirrel ears, and you can see the warblers clearly hopping among them. But this is one of those lush, lush springs, and I have really enjoyed it as a gardener, you know, because I've been able to get out and plant really early. I was just replanting everything yesterday, in fact. The peas, for whatever reason, didn't come up. It got hot and dry, so I replanted them. I replanted the lettuce, and I listen to the birds as I get, you know, hobble around on my knees in the garden. There's a lot going through right now.
Here's where I saw you named, I think, 15 species of birds.
Mm-hmm.
In another, it was about the yellow-breasted chats.
Oh yes, yes,
and that was from listening.
Yes. Yeah, it's kind of like a birder's game, you know. Once you learn all the songs, you can stand in one spot and listen and hear 40, 50 species at once. And filtering out those sounds that come to your ears and just separating one from the other is just such a joy. And it's really, you get into this sort of zen-like state where you can just hear them coming one after another. And I always take a little piece of paper with me and scribble them down.
When you hear the birds like that, are you sort of like, do you visualize them? I mean, how does it appear in your brain? What are you seeing or thinking?
Well, I grew up really birding in Southeast Ohio, and the gal, Pat Murphy, who was our birding mentor, she ran my mom's bird club that my mom belonged to, was really focused on teaching us the bird song. So she would give you a mnemonic for every bird song. So fire, fire, where, there, put it out. It's the indigo bunting. Not every indigo bunting says that, obviously, but that's kind of the pattern you remember. And when I hear that, it comes to me because years of hearing that, or, you know, barred owl, who cooks for you all. It's like it's a synapse connection, mm-hmm, in your brain.
You have to do the warbling vireo mnemonic.
Yeah. That Pat taught me that one. It shocked me that she would say this, but
can you say it on the
warbling
radio?
Vireo, it's nesting right out here outside your studio, right along the river. It's, if I see you, I will seize you. I will squeeze you till you squirt.
You know, but that's what it sounds.
Ever since I was 12, I've remembered that.
If I see you, I will squeeze you.
I will seize you. I will squeeze you till you squirt.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really
memorable.
It is memorable.
Yep.
614-292-8513. Give us a call. You can talk with Julie Zickafoos, Bill Thompson. They'll be at the Audubon Wine and Warblers event tonight at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center. For more information, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you if you're interested in learning more about it. Let's talk about your book, Bill. Peterson Field Guides, mm-hmm, The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. Has this been done before and it's a new?
Yeah, well, this is all of North America. The one I did before in 2008 was just Eastern North America because we wanted to keep it kind of small for small hands and limited. You know, these are.
But this is not a baby book.
No. It's, you know, it's aimed at 8 to 12 year olds, but the first woman that ever bought one after the first appearance I did when the book came out said, I'm buying this for my grandson. He's into birds. I'm not. She went out in the parking lot, flipped through it, came in, said, I'm buying one for me. You should have called this the New Birder's Guide.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the information translates. But I worked with Phoebe's class in fifth, and sixth grade years to develop the Eastern one. And then
Phoebe,
I worked,
your daughter.
Daughter Phoebe. Mm-hmm. And then I worked with Liam's class to update this one and add 100 Western species. So now it's good for all of North America as opposed to, you know, covers 300 species all across North America.
And on each page is a wow factor.
Right. That's kind of the attention grabber. I mean, my goal with this book was to make a book that a kid would open, see or read something that would just Velcro their brain a little bit so they'd want to flip the page. I figure if I get them to flip one page, I've got them. And birds are, you know, we talk about nature deficit disorder and kids disconnecting because they're all about technology and the digital realm. But you get... But birds are a really easy entree to the natural world. And even kids who are completely and, you know, online, technologically focused all the time, can groove on seeing a bald eagle or a peregrine falcon or a red-tailed hawk or even a hummingbird. So that's kind of what it's aimed at. I'm trying to hook a few minds into nature.
And how many birds do you say are in this?
300 now.
300. And yeah, that means there's 300. These are drawings that you've done, Julie?
I did 200 of them, okay. And our friend Michael
DiGiorgio. 200? Okay.
Yes, did the other 100.
Wow.
Yeah,
so there's a pencil drawing or of each. There's a photograph of each. There's a wow factor of each.
A little range map, a mm-hmm. place to check it off when you see it. And then little factoids trying to, you know, written in a lighthearted, engaging way, I hope, that will that'll be memorable, you know, like the Warbling Vireo song.
And also there's little listen fors. For instance, the Lincoln's Sparrow, Berber Z Trupp.
Right, exactly. Well done.
Ooh,
if I closed my eyes, I would have thought that was an actual Lincoln Sparrow.
I would too.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to a gray cat bird right now, and you guys can tell us about that. And I just picked this sound out because I like the name of the bird, which you guys know by now. It's what drives me.
Nesting right out here again.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Saw it this morning.
Gray cat bird. Very talkative, kind of squirrely.
Well, yeah. That's a mimid, and he's actually imitating songs. I heard red-eyed vireo in there. I heard goldfinch.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And,
the gray catbird isn't a fabulous mimic. It takes a little. He sort of filters it through a squeaky filter, so you have to kind of hear it as a gray catbird doing a goldfinch. But it's in there. He's imitating bird songs.
And the catbird's name for that. You heard one little meow kind of call in there.
Okay. Yeah, I did. I did. I'm not sure if that was what I was thinking about when I thought of it sounding kind of like a squirrel or something,
right.
But it might
mm-hmm.
have been.
Yeah.
And you heard that just outside.
Yeah. I saw one carrying food, actually, I think, probably to nestlings.
Now, they summer mm-hmm. in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But where do they live the rest of the year? Because that was kind of hard.
Catbirds are sort of short distance migrants. They're along the Gulf Coast and a little bit down into Mexico,
I think. Short distance.
Yeah, I don't think they get a lot farther south than that.
Yeah, compared to something like a black pole warbler or something, which is going to go nest up in the boreal forest in the far north and then migrate south to South America.
Do birds change their behavior much from, say, when they're up in Ohio versus when they're down, you know, in South America? Kind of like when people go to Vegas.
Oh, big time.
Oh, yeah. What happens in South America stays in South America.
Right. Well, here's the thing. You know, when they get to the Neotropics, they're faced with a completely different realm of vegetation types and of insect types. And so some of them that eat insects here will eat fruit all winter in the Neotropics because it's available. And so many of them undergo these radical shifts in their gastrointestinal systems and in their behavior. There are some that, like the chestnut-sided warbler, that's called, it's a bird that's very sort of ecologically timid. It knows one way to forage. It looks on the underside of leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And the chestnut-sided warbler does that here in North America, and it does it in South America too, but in Central America. But and then there are other species that completely change, like the eastern kingbird, which Bill heard right outside the studio here, is a flycatcher. Beautiful bird. And it eats almost exclusively insects. And when it goes to the Neotropics, it flocks with other kingbirds, and it eats cecropia fruit, which I find just amazing.
The gastrointestinal thing is amazing, too, because if we were to feed it that fruit up here during the summer, would that be good for them or not? Or do they need the switch?
They need the switch, and they wouldn't be able to raise their young on fruit.
Okay.
See,
right.
most of our birds raise their young on insects exclusively because the young are growing so fast they need the protein. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. My guest, Bill Thompson III, editor of Birdwatchers Digest. We've also been talking about his new book, The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. It's a Peterson Field Guide. And also Julie Zickafoos, natural history writer, artist, frequent guest on All Sides, and an NPR commentator. And we're going to talk a little bit more about her newest book, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the CIA says it stopped an Al-Qaeda plot to blow up a U.S.-bound airliner. We'll go deep on how they spotted the plot and the bomb threat now. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 66 degrees with partly sunny skies. There is a slight chance of rain today, otherwise sunshine and a high near 70 degrees. Mostly cloudy for tonight, a low of 43. Sunshine for Thursday, a high of 66. Clear skies Thursday night and a low of 43.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest, Bill Thompson III, he's editor of Birdwatcher's Digest and also author of his latest, The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America, and Julie Zicafus, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator, and author of her latest, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with
Common Birds. Yes.
Mm-hmm. If you have a question or comment for them, guess what? Nobody's called in. You be the first. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. They are going to be speaking tonight and appearing tonight at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center. If there are still tickets available for that, it's called the Wine and Warblers event. Can give us you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you to learn more about that. It's coming up on Mother's Day. Does your mother love birds? This would make a delightful.
My mother doesn't love wine.
Right. Oh, there is the wine part, too. Right. Good point.
You had me at wine.
It's hitting on both cylinders.
I could do a fake call if you want me to.
Well, we've got an email from Gail.
Okay.
What has happened to the veery and thrush? We live in the middle of 35 acres of woods and do hear the wood thrush, but I think they meant thrush, not right. Thrust. We do hear the wood thrush, but not as often as we used to. What is really upsetting is that we no longer hear the veery, which in our opinion has one of the most haunting, beautiful melodies.
Oh, yeah.
Help! From Gail.
Gail must live down in Hocking Hills.
I don't know. She doesn't say.
Up far north.
35 acres of woods is...
Veeries don't nest commonly in Ohio. They come through this time of year singing, and it's a great song. It's, you know, all the thrush songs are beautiful, and it kind of spirals downwards.
Someone whistling down a well.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible that Gail's habitat may have undergone some changes. The veery likes an open oak hickory woodland. With a lot of sunlight striking the forest floor, as opposed to some of the other thrushes that prefer a more shaded environment. So if the trees have matured sufficiently on her place, it may be that it's just no longer suitable for veeries. And those of us who live for a long time in one place, as Bill and I have lived for 21 years on our farm, and we're seeing the avian community turnover and change. And some things are going away and some things are coming in. So it's ranges and breeding ranges are very, very fluid. And you won't always hear the same species of bird on the same piece of land for decades and decades.
We used to have rough grouse drumming all spring long on our 80 acres in southeast Ohio. It's super rare to hear one now.
I write it down. It's a red letter day. I see one grouse a year now, whereas I always kick them up whenever I walked. The answer is simple. Our forest matured. The canopy closed over. The brush that they like was no longer in the understory. Right. The deer ate the brush out, too. And wild turkeys moved in. So there are many, many factors that pushed rough grouse off of our list.
Barbara in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you.
You have angry birds, not the kind on the computer, right?
Right.
Ooh, Barbara, we're having a really hard time hearing you. It's your cell phone. I'm sorry. If you can call back on a hard line, that would be great. But for some reason, your cell phone's not working. Jane in Gahanna, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Yes. I moved here from North Carolina, and I love the mockingbirds. Do we have mockingbirds here in Ohio? I have not heard.
Oh, yeah.
We
lots of mockingbirds. Yeah. In fact, from now until the end of the summer, you got a good chance at hearing them singing on moonlit nights. The lonely young bachelors that didn't find a mate will be singing all night long.
Well, they aren't anywhere near as common in Ohio as they would have been farther south, because
right.
I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and I miss mockingbirds terribly, too.
Yeah.
They're very strongly tied to urban areas where there are ornamentals that are planted that have fruit year-round. Because
right. Okay.
Mockingbirds are winter residents, and they have to have like a pyracantha bush or a holly or something that
right.
will sustain
okay.
them all winter. So if you aren't seeing
them,
they're
here all winter?
Yes, they are. They do not migrate.
Oh, my. I'm
right.
going to have to look more carefully then.
Well, it brings up a
okay.
question, though, Jane. It's something you could, in other words, you could plant something in your yard
right.
that possibly you'd have a better time attracting them. How have you amended your 80 acres over the last 21 years? Did you do much amendment when you first moved there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, when we moved in, there was one plant in the yard. It was a dahlia. And it just came up next to the air conditioner.
Wow.
And the rest was just thistles and
grass.
Nothing.
Mowed down to 2 inches.
Grass. And, so we've planted tons of things that birds love. We've planted mulberries and birches and willows. And we've planted hummingbird gardens all around the house. And we've planted a big, huge prairie patch. And then we've managed the meadows for native vegetation, like butterfly weed and things like that. So it's absolutely amazing to me the difference in the avifauna, you know, from when we moved in to now. We've brought bluebirds in by putting up boxes, tree swallows, chickadees right into the yard, just by putting up nest boxes. So there are a million things. In fact, I've written a book about it.
That's true.
Backyard birding. Backyard birding using natural gardening to attract birds.
Ding.
Rachel in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First of all, you were talking about the bluebird boxes. My brother is an Eagle Scout, and that was his project down in Shawnee Forest. I think he made 110 through
wow.
the Shawnee Forest, and I know for a fact at least 92 are still there as of a month ago. They went through and counted, and so.
Awesome.
But my question is still on the Boy Scouts. I have a Cub Scout troop. About 24 little boys, and we're going to be going to Hocking Hills, hopefully, within the next month. What is the most unique bird I can have them try to find on our scavenger hunt? One that's possible that they probably will see, but have seen all their lives or heard all their lives and didn't realize that's what they were seeing.
Well, okay, that's a really good question. Hocking Hills has a very special habitat. It's like a bit of the northern forest that's been plucked out and dropped in southeast Ohio. So you can see a lot of warblers there that that don't nest commonly anywhere else in southeast Ohio, like black-throated green warbler and magnolia warbler, black-throated blue warbler. You can find these things just along the roadways. But another good one would be the veery that an earlier caller mentioned. There are veeries nest in the Hocking Hills. I think it's these sandstone cliffs that are aligned so that they don't get a lot of sunlight. They're filled with hemlocks. They're very cool. So you get a lot of northern species down there in Hocking Hills.
Winter wren is another possible
yep.
one. That has the longest continuous song of any North American bird. It sounds like a little silver waterfall that just cascades on and on. So I would encourage you to get some of the hemlock specialty birds like winter wren and black-throated green warbler,
okay.
and get some recordings online and have your kids listen to them and see if they can maybe hear a winter wren in the Hocking Hills.
Okay. I definitely plan on getting the North American book, not only for one just for my troop, but one for myself and one for my nephew. So this is great. And I'm sorry, I came into the show late. Where can I get the book?
Just about anywhere. It's
okay.
called The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America, Bill Thompson III. And also The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds by Julie Zickafoos. Beautiful, beautiful painting.
And Julie, didn't you do the illustrations for the Bird Merit Badge for the Boy Scouts?
I did. If
you
I'd forgotten that. Thanks,
right.
Will. Yes, if you have the Birding Merit Badge booklet for the Boy Scouts, then I did the illustrations in it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
It was
okay.
fun.
Well, thank you so much for the information.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Rachel, good luck and thanks. She gave me an idea. Maybe we should post the website where at OSU that provided bird sounds, mm-hmm. you know, that we're listening to now, the recordings we're listening to today. I can't say the whole website out loud. It's too long, but you can go to our website. We'll post that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. My guests this hour, Bill Thompson III, editor of Birdwatchers Digest, also the author of a new book, Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America, and Julie Zicafus. Many, many things, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator, and author of her latest book, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Uncommon Birds, and also apparently the illustrator for the Boy Scouts of America's birding booklet.
One of my many. I did fishing, too. Yeah. So I did a lot of trout.
Wow, you do underwater. Okay.
I do underwater scenes.
From life.
Well, let's listen to the cliff swallow.
Okay.
And tell us what you can about that.
Bridge.
That's kind of creepy sounding.
Yeah, it is.
It sounds like something from like a Hitchcock.
And I don't want to scare you, but they're nesting under the bridge right on the other side of the Alumni Center.
Really? Yeah, Bill found a colony. They build these wonderful little jug-shaped mud nests, and they glue them up under bridges. And they're very local in Ohio. You know, they'll be in one place and not in another.
This is a bird that they'll probably at some point change its name to the bridge swallow.
Yeah.
It used to nest in cliffs, but then we put up all these sort of fake cliffs for them to nest on, and it's a great bird. It's a really, really beautiful bird.
If it was cliffs for which they're named, and we don't have cliffs unless you're maybe a little bit in the Hocking Hills area mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. then do they kind of gradually come to be here?
My guess is, I mean, we've seen them nesting on cliffs out west,
Because there's cliffs out west.
Right, but it's sort of like purple martins, you know, that they realized when the Native Americans would put up gourds. And they figured out how to nest in them. And then the martins were eating the bugs off their drying meat, and it was a symbiotic thing. Martins almost exclusively nest in human-supplied housing now. Cliff swallows, phoebes, these are birds that love to nest, you know, on human-supplied structures because there's so many more of them, and they're very safe from predators. So my guess is probably the first covered bridge that went up somewhere, cliff swallows started nesting under it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, rough-wing swallows, you can almost always find them in those truck yards where they put the semi-containers and line them up and leave them there for months or years. Rough-wing swallows poke their little nests back in these struts underneath the truck body. So it's no coincidence if you see these beautiful rough-wing swallows circling and diving around truck bodies. That's the easiest place to find them.
We have an email from Amy. She writes, is there a list of mnemonics related to bird songs printed anywhere? It would be very helpful.
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a good question.
You know, we've published them in Birdwatchers Digest. And
intermittently or
we've published full articles about them. We should really post that. Again, I'll try to get a PDF of that up on our website, birdwatchersdigest.com, because we've had probably at least 10 articles on bird mnemonics over the years. My guess is somebody's got a website out there devoted to it. If you just Google mnemonics.
Right.
Mnemonics for bird songs.
Right. And because, you know, people love those mnemonics. And they're very helpful to remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find them helpful. Email from Robert. During the past week or so, I have seen 3 white-crowned sparrows on the ground near my feeders and under a big white pine and at an aviary at the same place.
Ooh.
Each of these species was only seen on one day. I see the sparrows about every year, but this is the first aviary I have seen, or at least it appeared to be a aviary to me.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure.
It's migration right now. Everything's moving through.
They're on their way, and the white-crowned sparrows are on their way far, far north, almost to the Arctic Circle, and they nest in the muskeg, which is the little dwarf bushes in tundra almost. It's amazing. These things are just stopping by our feeders, tanking up, and off they go.
White-crowned sparrows you can find at bird feeders in the winter, white-crowned and white-throated sparrows,
uh-huh.
pretty commonly here in Ohio, all through the winter, and then they start splitting for the north.
They like cold weather then.
They breed well in the northern realms. Yeah, it's probably food related. They're these insect flushes in the northern forest that and in the muskeg that we don't have here, you know, that makes it impossible to be out there basically. And that's great for the birds because they can feed their young such this great flush of insects.
Janet in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm actually calling for my mother. She lives in Grove City, but I think you may have answered the question. She is always upset when she sees the big hawks because then she loses her sparrows and goldfinches. And a friend of mine is a really good birder, and she said maybe it's just because the hawks are breeding and so forth. You know, like they think that my mother's bird feeder is like McDonald's or something. So, yep. but you just said about the sparrows that maybe they go north. Maybe I can explain that to her. Is that probably what's happening?
I would be very surprised if she could see an appreciable decrease in the population of any given bird at her feeder thanks to the presence of a hawk. Now, it may cause them to leave the area when the hawk appears,
right.
but predation doesn't work like that. A predator like a hawk doesn't clean out one species selectively. They take one here, they take one there. There are plenty more where those came from.
I love them because I consider I'm on the road a lot for work and drive a lot, and I call them my road angels because when I see them, I figure I'm having a good day.
You bet. That's lovely. Well, you know, those would be red-tailed hawks that you'll see sitting along the roadside with the big white breast sitting like a jug up in the tree.
Yeah.
What your mother probably has at her feeders is probably a Cooper's hawk, which is now the urban hawk.
That's what my friend Sheila said.
Yes. Okay,
great.
Oh, yes.
Well, thank you so much for all the info. I'll just let Mom know. No, don't freak out. It's not the hawk's problem.
Tell her to enjoy them.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet.
Bye.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for my guests. Bill Thompson III, editor of Birdwatchers Digest and author of a new book now, among many others, Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America. Also, Julie Zickafoos, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator, and author of another new book, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back and continue our conversation about birds. On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the imam famous for trying to build an interfaith Islamic center near Ground Zero. His new book is called Moving the Mountain, Beyond Ground Zero to a New Vision of Islam in America. Also, Gretchen Reynolds talks about the latest scientific research into exercise and fitness. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City online auction. You can bid now on fabulous Chefs in the City culinary theme packages. New items are constantly being added, and items close on a weekly basis. All proceeds benefit children's educational programming on WOSU. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to view all items up for bid.
Support for 89.7 comes from Catco. Catco's comedic adaptation of The 39 Steps, based on a film by Alfred Hitchcock and full of Monty Python-esque humor, is on stage May 9th through June 3rd at the Rife Center. Details at catco.org.
Join us for All Signs with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a discussion of physics and dark matter and a supernova revealed in the universe. And then in the second hour, young adult fiction comes to age. That's All Signs tomorrow from 10 until noon. 66 degrees with some sunshine. There is a slight chance of rain this afternoon, otherwise sunshine and a high of 70. Clouds for tonight, a low of 43. And All Signs continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guests this hour, Julie Zickafoos, we've been talking about, or we will talk about, if we haven't yet, her new book, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds, and also Bill Thompson III, editor of Birdwatchers Digest and author of a new book himself, Young Birder's Guide to Birds of North America, including 20 drawings of birds from Julie Zickafoos.
200.
Did I say 20? I just saw two and a
no,
zero
two,
in my
I
mind.
Thought.
And they work very closely together. They live together. They are married. So if you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sarah in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, I'm really enjoying it.
Thanks.
I love spring migration, getting to see some of these birds that you otherwise wouldn't see. And I had, I was very excited to have for 2 days, two male rose-breasted grosbeaks at my platform feeder.
Woohoo!
Oh, it was so exciting.
They're great.
Yes, and of course, I was glued to the window, and then they left, and I'm just wondering where they're headed.
Well, they do nest in Ohio, mostly in northern Ohio, a little bit down the Hocking Hills, and sporadically elsewhere, but they love old forest and deciduous woods. They're insect eaters this time of year. You want to jump in here, Jules?
Yes, and, you know, they're really expanding their range, it seems. We have them breeding in Washington County, Ohio, which is down by Marietta, which is a brand new thing. It used to be they only bred as far south as about Akron, Canton. And I remember seeing one building a nest at a roadside rest stop in Canton, and I was like, wow, you've got these up here. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that they could start nesting right around here.
Yeah, but the neat thing about rose-breasted grosbeaks is they come back from the tropics, and this time of year they stop at people's feeders to eat some sunflower seed.
It's so great.
And it's you know, it's really cool. They're a big finch, really, and so when they show up, people notice this black and white bird with a brilliant crimson sort of scarf on its chest. It's a pretty hard to miss bird, and people get very excited about it. So,
and it was also very interesting to watch the behavior, because the one rose-breasted grosbeak was trying to prevent the other bird from feeding. Huh. So I was wondering if maybe it could possibly be one of its offspring that traveled with it. One seemed a lot larger, and one looked a little more tethered than the other one. You know, not in bad shape by any means, mm-hmm. but one was
tattered.
Yeah, one was just outstanding. But yes. One would actually kind of open his beak and almost like a little hiss at the other one to try to prevent it from getting on the platform and feeding. So the behavior, too, was very interesting.
I think rose-breasted grosbeaks, I may be wrong about this, but I believe they migrate in single-sex flocks. So I think the males come first.
Oh. Right.
And that kind of, you know, defending the food resources, pretty common feeder behavior. But what you picked up on is a lot of them look kind of motley and mottled this time of year, and that's because they're last year's babies. And they are still getting their coloration. So if you saw brown in the wing and speckles on the head and back, it was last year's young male that's just now coming into breeding plumage.
Oh, okay. And if you have time, one more comment.
Okay, Sarah.
Okay. I live in an area where we have mature trees, I mean oaks, and I have walnut trees in my backyard and ash trees, so it's an area that has a lot of mature trees. And what is interesting to me, for the last 2 years, I have had bluebirds in the backyard, and they are nesting here. I've watched them bring in their young to the bird bath. And interesting behavior the other day is I had a bluebird, the male bluebird, attempting to feed at the suet feeder.
Hmm.
So I started just scraping off little pieces of suet and putting them on the just in an area where, you know, the bluebird could land. And I watched both the male and the female coming in and just loading up on the suet and flying to feed the young, obviously.
Yes.
But I'm just wondering if their behavior where they nest, is that changing, or am I just lucky to have them here?
I think you're lucky to have them. They're tied to woodpecker holes if you don't have a nest box in your yard. They're probably nesting in a cavity that was previously made by a downy or hairy woodpecker. So
probably in some nearby open patch of habitat.
Sure.
Is where they are.
Sure, they're probably commuting to feed if you live in the forest.
One of those Dublin fields, Sarah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They will nest, their cavity limited, their nest site limited, so they'll nest wherever they find a cavity. And it sounds like you're ripe for a bluebird box in your yard.
Well, I had a bluebird box in my yard, but not on a standing pole.
Right.
And they actually built a nest in there, and guess what? I have raccoons.
Oh, yeah.
You need a predator baffle. If you go to my website, juliezickafoos.com, go to the contact box, and I will send you plans for a stovepipe predator baffle that will keep the raccoons off your house.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right,
thank you.
Sarah. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
That reminded me of at our bird bath the other day, I saw, I don't know, it was like four or five different birds, and they were different kinds, although they might have been related, but I, you know, but anyways, they were taking turns.
Yeah.
One would jump on the bird bath and splash around, and then it would jump out. And another one would jump up and splash around. It was really cute.
That's how they key into the bath. And, you know, it's so funny. We see that same thing. They stack up, but we put snags right next to the bird bath so the birds can stack up on there and wait their turn to bathe. And we notice that they bathe the most frequently when we've just washed the bird bath, just cleaned it.
Right. Or after a rain.
Exactly.
And that's happened.
When we've just washed the bird bath.
Oh, I know about we, too.
Right.
I love we. We does a lot for me. Let's listen to the hairy woodpecker. You just mentioned it, and let's listen to it. Okay, I know they're nesting now because I saw a family of hairy woodpeckers the other day nesting.
Yeah, we have the hairy and downy woodpeckers, both really common here in Ohio. And hairy's a little bit bigger. We say hairy is huge, downy is dinky. The hairy's got a more massive bill, about as long as the head is wide. And the white on the outer tail feathers is pure white. It doesn't have any black in it. Downy has white outer tail feathers with little black chevrons on it and a shorter, more dainty bill, if you will. But the interesting thing about that call there, the hairy's got a really loud peek, peek call that you often hear. I just heard them right out here. And then when it does that rattle, it stays horizontal, hairy horizontal. Downy's rattle goes down. It drops in tone. So that's you probably hear them more often than you see them.
We have lots of emails from Ruthie in Minnesota.
Ruthie.
Hi, Ruthie. Do you know Ruthie?
I do.
Okay. Big fan, then. I don't have a question, but just want to say that I've birded with Julie and Bill before at birding festivals, and the really cool thing about them is that even though they're two of the best birders in the world, they're so nice and not at all full of themselves and their birding knowledge. They may have seen that particular bird 100 times before, but when they see it with someone else who's getting it as a life bird, which means first time they've ever seen it, they're just as excited for that person as if it was actually their first time seeing it, too. Julie and Bill make birding awesome and fun.
Oh, how sweet.
That is very
she
nice.
She clearly doesn't really know us at all.
You know what Ruthie did? She knitted me a pair of bison wool wristlets and a little bison wool throat warmer. She is an awesome knitter.
Wow.
Yes.
Ruthie, thanks for the email. Email from Bob. I keep seeing small birds with short pointed wings swooping after insects in small groups or large flocks, often swooping low over rivers and ponds. They move so fast it's hard to make out any markings. No bright colors are apparent. They look gray with paler bellies. Is there a common bird that fits this description?
Yes.
We aren't going to tell you,
no,
though.
It's the bald eagle. No, he's probably seeing swallows, maybe chimney swifts, but probably rough-winged swallows, tree swallows. Any body of water this time of year, especially on a cool day or cool morning, the insects congregate right over the water, and that's where the swallows and swifts are catching insects, because that's what they do. They eat flying insects caught on the wing.
Email from Jessica. Julie, could you give us an update on Garrett, the red-headed woodpecker? I think I read on your blog that he is back. Where do you think he went while he was MIA? Do you think he'll stay?
Oh, how sweet. Well, this person obviously reads my blog. We fell hard in love with a red-headed woodpecker who came to our feeders. They're very uncommon in Ohio now, and they're declining throughout their range. This is the bird that is black, white, and red. Absolutely gorgeous. Garrett stayed for about a month and a half to 2 months in our yard. I fed Garrett everything I could think of, homemade Zik dough, mealworms, peanuts, cracked corn, sunflower seed, sunflower hearts. And we put up a box for Garrett, which Garrett moved into, and it was such a thrill. Well, then the darn bird took off and went to our neighbor's house, and all he does is throw out a handful of cracked corn about once a day. And took up residence in the big water maple in the yard, and has stayed. Probably the last sighting was about a month ago,
the last good sighting.
We think that Garrett was probably a female, and we hope that she's moved on to find another,
to find a mate. Misnamed slightly.
Garrett.
Redheaded woodpeckers aren't sexually dimorphic, so the males and females look alike. All adult redheaded woodpeckers are red, black, and white.
And that's unusual in the woodpecker world.
Really. Yeah. And it's my favorite bird. Of all the birds, the red-headed woodpecker is my favorite. It's one I saw as a kid growing up in Iowa. And to get one at our feeder was, we've been there 20 years. We've never had one at the feeder other than a stop-by visit. But right. So this was really cool.
It was wonderful.
Jennifer in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I have a question about barred owls. And
shoot.
I have a pair that live here on my property. They actually had moved into my chimney, which was not convenient. So this season we built them a box and they moved in. And they had a clutch last year, and now this year we're watching the babies try to make their way out of the box. And my son wants to know, he's 8, he wants to know how many years that they will have babies.
What do you mean? The reproductive lifespan of the bird?
Yeah. He wants to know how many times that they will come and habitate in the box and lay eggs.
Well, you know, birds don't typically live very long, but bigger birds like owls have a little bit better shot at living a long time.
Okay.
They'll keep coming back as long as they're successful, I would think.
I would think that a barred owl could breed into its 20s and 30s. But the problem is that they aren't all that faithful to one given nest site.
Right.
If a better place shows up somewhere else, they may move on. But to have barred owls in a nesting box in your yard, are you kidding?
That's really cool.
Oh, no, we watch them right out the dining room window. We put it up high enough so that we can see. We have great pictures. They fish.
That's amazing.
They've carried in snakes. They've carried in, like, night crawlers. It's incredible. It's like having a pet you don't have to take care of. They're amazing birds.
That is a wonderful way to put it. I'm going to paint a picture for you. Do you know how barred owls forage a lot of the time?
Not really. We've never been lucky enough. I've seen her pounce. I've never actually seen her scoop anything up off the ground that was behind a fence.
Okay, well, picture this. These things eat a lot of crayfish, and if you find the pellets cast, you can find crayfish parts in them. They actually walk in stream beds in the dark, in the night, turning over rocks with their feet. And
you're
getting
kidding.
Yes, and getting crayfish out from under them. It's so awesome.
Right. They love wet woods.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, we're right on a ravine. We're right on the east side of the reservoir.
Yes.
The stream feeds into the reservoir, and I've seen them with fish in their clutches.
Fantastic.
Wow, so
you know,
cool.
Write down everything you see because you may be contributing to ornithological knowledge by doing that. We just, you know, we don't know that much about these nocturnal birds.
Well, you know, last year when they had their babies, we saw them a lot during the day. This year we're seeing them a lot during the day now that they're kind of hunting all day long. And then we went a good four months without seeing them at all.
Hmm.
And then they just showed back up.
Oh, you're so lucky.
So,
well, thanks for sharing that, Jennifer.
Cool.
Sure, I will tell my son. As long as we keep a good house, hopefully they'll come back.
Bill is making me do
the
my
barred owl call.
Barred owl
okay,
call,
barred owl
which
call
I would like
time.
To do. You need no recording.
We don't have one.
You ready?
Don't blow out your ears.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
You're amazing.
Seriously, who needs an iPod?
I have to get to Dave because you're going to be very excited.
Okay.
Dave in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
So we live close to Brookside Country Club and had, I think it was 8 redhead woodpeckers calling back and forth from tree to tree.
Oh, man.
And I saw a lot of bright red ones because they nest in the trees, but some lighter reds. And you just said the males and the females are the same. Are those you?
You know, the males and females are the same when they're adults. But like last year's baby that's coming into adult plumage, like Julie said earlier with the rose-breasted grosbeak, they could look a little duller. Then they're also sometimes the young birds from last year would still have a gray head. I don't think they'd have babies out of the nest yet.
No, not at all. They're a late migrant. They're probably just arriving on the breeding grounds. Do they stay all winter?
No. Mm-hmm. We don't see them in the winter. They nest. We've got holes in some of our trees.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been here about maybe 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And they were just making lots of noise, calling to each other, chasing each other around. And it had to have been, you know, obviously they're looking for pairs, I think, to pair up.
Right.
Or is it a family that's coming back that uses this area?
Well, they're semi-colonial, so they like to nest in loose colonies in appropriate places, which is, I'm guessing, you have huge oaks with a lot of mown grass underneath.
Yeah, open underneath the oaks.
Yep, exactly. On ash trees, a lot of old growth trees. That's exactly what it is.
That's what they need, and that's why they're so scarce, because people cut the valuable trees.
Dave, I want to get to some more calls. We got a bunch of emails, but thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
My favorite bird.
Absolutely. It was,
you know, yeah. I mean, it's Bill's favorite bird. You know, I had to take that call right away. I got email from Sally. I was driving north maybe a month ago on Olentangy River Road near Henderson Road and witnessed a very large bird tumbling at very high speed from a high altitude towards the earth. It was rather shocking, and I was afraid that the bird was falling to its death when it swooped upwards. Could this have been an eagle, and is this common behavior?
Yes and yes. More than likely, it was a red-tailed hawk. They're a little bit more common than eagles here in central Ohio, and they do a courtship. A lot of the raptors do a courtship swooping dive like that for the mate, you know, that would be watching, and they swoop down, and I mean, it's high speeds, and you think, oh my gosh, this thing's going to crash, and then they just come right out of it, you know, like a stunt plane would.
The things they do for love.
Exactly.
Email from Paul. I recommend the website All About Birds from Cornell University. It has an extensive search capability and also provides sound files of bird calls. Thank you, Paul. We use that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
On a local note, we spotted a pair of ospreys fishing the headwaters of Deer Creek Lake near Pancoastburg. I don't know where Pancoastburg is. So I wish I would know more about that. Email from Lori in Olmsted Falls, Ohio. I have both the young birders' guides and the ones we take when we're birding, since we're not only young, 50 and 60 years old, but also newbies. Yay, Lori. Also have Julie's lovely new book, The Bluebird Effect, wonderful writing and illustrations. One question, when you're talking about a vireo, is that the bird spelled V-I-R-E-O in my books? Just wondering. And thanks for introducing us to the world of birding. It is spelled V-E-E-R-Y, right?
Right. And a vireo is a thrush, sort of similar to a wood thrush related to the robin and the bluebird. A vireo, V-I-R-E-O, is a small bird that's more closely related to the warblers.
We have time for just one more call. Brett, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know that there's a couple of great oriole nests on the Scioto River in Bishopier Park. And some of the birds have hatched, and I just wanted to know if it was common that they look like hornet's nests kind of hanging down off of the tree, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Sure, yeah. The orioles like to build their nests on the extreme outer branches of trees. I'd be surprised if they've hatched yet, because the orioles are just now coming back from migration. So you may be seeing last year's nests, but the females are just now beginning to gather nesting material. We had one in our yard doing that yesterday. So I think the timing would be that they're just now nest building.
An email from Jen. I have a question about two things I have observed, and I want to know if there's any truth to my observations. I never remember seeing many crows growing up in Ohio, but they seem to be common sight right now. Mm-hmm. Now, secondly, blue jays seem to disappear for many years, but I've noticed a return of blue jays in the last couple of years. Are these real trends or just my imagination?
They're definitely real trends. Crows used to get persecuted heavily by farmers, and they had bounties on them. And West Nile virus wiped out a lot of crows and blue jays about 10 years ago, and they're coming back now.
Yeah. All right, there you go. Thanks a lot, Jen, for that. And thanks to my guests, Bill Thompson III, editor of Birdwatchers Digest and author of Young Birders Guide to Birds of North America.
Thank you, man.
Bill, great. Julie Zickafoos, natural history writer, artist, blah, many things. I was just going to say blah, blah, blah.
Portmanteau woman.
The bluebird effect.
Owl collar.
Common bonds with common birds. That was bad. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. Streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 MP. PR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. I'm